Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. And what a fantastic episode we have. We've got two brilliant authors on the podcast today for you. We're going to be talking to A.J. Close, who's written a novel called Trust. We'll also be talking to David Mitchell, the author of Cloud Atlas and Number 9 Dream, both shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And he'll be talking about his latest novel, The Bone Clocks. But we're going to start the podcast today with A.J. Close. She's a novelist and dramatist. Her first novel was long listed for the Orange Prize, and here she is talking about her latest book, Trust.
My name is A.J. Close, and the book is Trust. It follows a group of very disparate characters who work in two industries, both propped up by the public purse at some point. One of them is mining, and the other one is banking. And it follows these characters through 30 years and takes them through two seismic events, the first one being the miners' strike and the second one being the recent banking crisis. I first had the idea for the book probably about 15 years ago, but the seeds of it were sown a long time before, because when I left college, I went north to train as a reporter in a small mining town known as Worksop. And my friends at college, a lot of them went south to London to enter the city. So they were working as bankers, as brokers, as management consultants. In this small town where I was a cub reporter, there were three collieries, and there were a large number of pits outside, which were also part of my patch. So by and large, my friends were miners, and night after night, we'd go to the pub, we'd talk about what was happening in their industry. This was the early 80s, so although the miners' strike hadn't happened, it was very clear that it was going to happen. And then once or twice a year, I'd go down to London and see my old friends, and they would talk about what was happening in their industry. And gradually, it dawned on me that they worked for the industry that was saying, you know, your friends, your miner friends, their industry's not viable, it's going to have to go. So it was interesting being on both sides of the fence. And much later, when I was a novelist, I thought I'd like to put a character in that position. But for me, it was just a social thing. It didn't really matter. For Lexa, it's her job. She is working for a merchant bank, but her sympathies are with the miners. And so I thought that was a good place to start for a novel.
Yeah, I guess they're both two sides of the same coin. So it's so uncanny that you caught that 15, 20 years ago, because obviously with the banking crisis and the dilemmas that the banking industry have had recently, it seems that that's kind of come full circle in a way. I mean, it seems like a very prescient time to be thinking about banking and mining, using mining as a way to talk about banking today, right?
Yeah, I mean, timing is absolutely everything in publishing novels. So this one, I started, as I say, about 15 years ago, and then there was a 10-year gap where I got so far with it, got stuck, went on to other projects, wrote plays and other novels, and then came back to it. And I have to say, I'm not saying I'm glad the banking crisis happened, but it certainly provided me with a good way to end the novel, because in the second half of the novel is set in 1983-84, and then we jump to 2006. There's three main characters, three women, Lexa, Gabriel and Ray. And as I said, the first bit is set in the north of England. They're in Scotland for the second half of the book, and only one of them is working in banking. The other two have moved on to other things. But the one who is working in banking is implicated in the banking crisis and gets suspended. And that's what kicks off the second half of the narrative.
And it's such an interesting arc, because in the 1980s, right, these were masters of the universe and now quite vilified. And actually, my friends who work in finance and banking can't quite understand why people don't like them so much.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, we are talking about a massive split, really, between the people who are making these ludicrous sums of money. I think it was Polly Toynbee wrote a book. She did a lot of research about what people who worked in finance in London thought. And she asked them to guess things like what the level of income support was and that sort of thing. And they had no idea. And when they were actually told, they were profoundly shocked. They couldn't believe that anybody could survive on so little money. And actually, that's a fair point, you know. But they really, you know, these are some of the people who are saying, you know, benefits claimants, they're scroungers and all the rest of it. But They really did had no idea. And I guess you can say on the other side, people who are existing on benefits have no idea what it's like to live, you know, and work in the finance industry. I mean, I'm lucky because those friends who I knew when I was at university, I have, you know, I'm still friends with, and they've climbed the tree, and some of them are very senior. Some of them got so senior they've actually retired now. But
wow.
I was able to talk to them about banking, and things have changed. One of the things, a lot of the book concerns the sexual politics and the, you know, the terrible sexism which existed in banking in the 1980s, and you know, those sex discrimination cases keep on coming. Clearly there are still problems, but things are much tighter now, although this hasn't necessarily served women well, because a lot of men just believe that women who are senior have got there because, well, they've had it made easy for them, you know. So there's a downside to that. But certainly the sort of routine sexist remarks that were encountered in the 1980s, by and large, don't go on anymore, you know, because people know they can lose their jobs for it, or at least a multi-million pound lawsuit can be brought, you know.
That joke's not worth it, is
no,
it?
That's right. So it is, but it was interesting talking to them about it. And the thing about it is, you say to them, the first thing you say is, who needs all that money? I mean, you read in the newspapers about their bonuses, and it's just mind-boggling. And you say, who needs it? And they say, it's not the money, it's just keeping score. They don't need all that money either.
We should give them gold stars.
Well, that's right. It would be cheaper.
How hard was it to create a character? Because this is something that it's quite a conflict, isn't it? The conflict is embodied in one person. She's working at a bank, but she has sympathies with the miners. How hard is it to create a character who's realistically involved in those two worlds? And I guess there must be some, you know, there's a schism, right? It's
yeah.
hard to go to work every day when your sympathies lay elsewhere, but you also have a loyalty to the job and the career that you've made for yourself. It must be very difficult to put a character in that position.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is, she's a very idealistic woman. I mean, she's a feminist and she's also quite socialist. The way I did it was, I mean, I was a career journalist. Journalists in general did a lot of things I didn't approve of while I was a journalist. I didn't do many of those things. In fact, I'm not sure I did any, but there is a sort of, you know, there is a bit of a bad smell around journalism. But nevertheless, I was the first to, you know, defend press freedom and all the rest of it for a long time. And I think you have a sort of professional head, and you get in there and you think, I want to be the best there can be at this. And so there is that split internally, I think, in people. And certainly there is in this character. I mean, she... And it gets to be about, she's very much at odds with her colleagues because most of them are men. They are very sexist. So she thinks, I want to show you. And the way to show them is by doing a really, really good job. But that means doing a good job within the terms of the bank, you know. I mean, in the end, the conflicts become unsustainable, and she does something which takes her completely out of that.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That's not a spoiler. That's good.
No, that's right. I'm not going to say what, but it's fairly dramatic. That's all I can say.
Dun, dun, dun.
AJ Close, everybody. Thanks so much to her for taking the time to sit down and talk to us. Her latest book is Trust. Go out and get a copy. You can also follow AJ on Twitter at AJ Close. And while we're talking about it, go and find us. We're at Scottish BK Trust. Follow us, please, for the latest information about the things that we're doing. You can also like us on Facebook. Just click on the thumbs up button on our Scottish Book Trust page. Or if you want, go to our website, scottishbooktrust.com. We'd love to see you there. Now, if you subscribe to our podcast, you'll know our previous episode featured a conversation about David Mitchell's latest Booker long-listed book, The Bone Clocks. And we're very pleased now to feature David Mitchell on the podcast.
My name's David Mitchell, and I'm the author of a book called The Bone Clocks. It's about the life of its protagonist. She's called Holly Sykes. We meet her first in 1984 when she's a rebellious teenage punkette running away from home. We meet her in the second part of the book. She's a young woman working in Switzerland in a ski resort. In the third section, it's the first decade of this century, and she has a child with a foreign correspondent who's back from Iraq, the Battle of Fallujah, specifically for a family wedding. In the present decade, here's a spoiler, she becomes a widow, and is also the improbable author of a book that becomes a massive international success. Fifth part's to bonkers to really be able to do here. The sixth part, she's a grandmother and guardian of a ward on a beautiful peninsula of Ireland called the Sheep's Head Peninsula. As civilization is crumbling away for lack of oil. This is the parabola of her life. Into her life, every decade, every section of the book, erupts a murderous feud between two circles of immortals, one of which is predatory, the other is more or less benign. Holly, in this feud, well, when she's a kid, she's just a minor chess piece, but by the end of it, she becomes a decisive weapon. That's what the Americans call an elevator pitch. It was a long elevator, but we're at the top of the building now.
Is the process of writing, does it start with an overall idea, or do you just start in that, boom, 1984, we've got a kid running away from home. You know, it's just such a brilliant and captivating opening. Does it grow from there, or are you somebody who plans the entire arc of this novel, and as well, not just the realistic elements, but the fantastical elements as well?
This has got a short answer. It is, of course, a combination of the two. You can't plan a 600-something page novel in its entirety without actually writing it, actually. So I think there are components you know you want to get in from the beginning, but of course you don't know how you will be able to combine them all. If you can combine them all, you may not be able to. In some cases I wasn't, and some things had to go and were replaced by other things along the way. So yeah, it's partly pre-planned and partly found in progress.
You know, when it comes to like talking about these characters, like, you know, we've got these kind of ordinary mortals and this incredibly realistic and captivating story that goes throughout and through, told from a number of perspectives, like the war reporter I found incredibly compelling. All of these amazing kind of scenes. And then, of course, you've got this fantastical, immortal story saga going on throughout. And it made me question kind of, made me think about like, well, this concern about time. And it seems to be a kind of recurrent theme, at least in some of your work, you know, the passage of time. The book spans from, what, 1984 to
42 or something. Yeah.
And it does so, I mean, this is the amazing thing about it, is it does so elegantly. Like, you notice the shifts, but like, there's something about the way that time passes in this novel that feels very true to our experiences, which is like not these huge mega shifts. I mean, towards the end, obviously, everything gets really crazy, but you're still very much, you feel like there's a progress and a building. Is that hard to control, like, and to not leap and be like, we're going to have spaceships now?
It's simpler than you might think. You just keep it in the background. We just think about our own lives. We've seen a lot of changes in our world and in ourselves and in our bodies since a decade we became sentient adults. I'm guessing in your case, the 1980s, like me. The changes are, I mean, of course, changes permeate everything from ourselves to how we live to what we do to the planet, but it's rarely in the foreground. So when I write, when I try to recreate these decades, or in the case of future decades, create them, I don't have sticky fluorescent post-it notes attached to the ways that the world is different from the present. They're simply there, somewhat backgrounded. We don't walk around thinking of the changes to our bodies and our minds because they come so gradually. We always feel that we're us, yet we're actually very different organisms compared to how we were when we were 6 years old in all sorts of ways. But we don't walk around sort of constantly clobbered by the momentousness of these changes. And so for people, as for fictional people, my characters also don't engage in long ruminating backflashes about how she's, say in the case of Holly, she's now a mother with a daughter and not a teenage runaway, because we don't. So just stay true to life and how we perceive the passing decades, and you probably won't go too far wrong.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's interesting because, right, you don't know it was the 90s until you look back at a picture of yourself in the 90s, and you're like, oh, wow, that was so 90s.
Yeah, I look so young. That's why photographs can be quite a disturbing, disorientating phenomena.
Yeah, you put yourself back, you know, when you think of yourself in university or whatever, it's my face, my body, my current
experience, and it's not. That's not true. You know, it's a really weird thing. The much of the book is written in the present tense, isn't it?
It just felt right. I tried the past to start off with. I knew it needed to be the first person. First person's kind of my home style, my home perception, I guess. But first person present tense. It's not to everyone's taste, but I can just write the book I want to write, and I can't do it for all people.
Yeah, but it seems very, in control, I guess, alongside that idea of not seeing time pass when you're in the present, getting a full scope, especially with all the fantastical elements as well. Those characters have a very long perception of time, of existence. They've been existing since, what was it, the 5th century?
Yeah, in the case of Malinus, yeah. I mean, there's a few who are even older. First-person present tense seems to me to sort of most closely replicate the experience of consciousness. We do have backflashes and flash-forwards in how we think, or foreshadowings, but we tend to perceive the moment as a kind of a home that moves through time, and there are costs and benefits depending on which of the very small number of modes you're going to use to tell the story in. But it just felt first person present tense was the right one for this.
Can you explain a little bit about where you hit on the idea of the bone clocks, humans as bone clocks? It's such a grim idea.
Well, I suppose so. If it's grim, it's only grim because mortality is grim, or you feel mortality is grim. I mean, maybe one of the reconciliations you need to make as you enter the second phase, kind of the second half of your life, is that mortality, if you're going to view it as this awful nihilistic end with a capital E, then grim is certainly the word. But if perhaps you can maybe cultivate a more fruitful companionship with it, invite mortality to be a companion who kind of walks with you and just gently reminds you, don't waste this day, I won't be coming back again. Don't spend this day being impatient. Just shut your mouth and calm down, and don't let your temper flare up because it'll spoil the week, and this week won't be coming back again. And maybe you can use mortality in a more constructive way, which some other cultures are rather better at doing, I feel, than ours.
I mean, that's something that I think the book does for me, is really makes us consider mortality and legacy, what we leave behind, you know, and what we're doing here, I guess.
Things we leave behind, both in a positive way, as in a legacy, but also in a negative way, a deforested, overheated world, which brings us into intergenerational ethics, really, doesn't it? Sort of the idea that we are funding our godlike standards of living on a tab that will be payable not by us, but by our children or our grandchildren.
That last section of the book hits that pretty hard.
Well, it's a thing that needs to be hit hard. I have no answers. We need energy that is cheap and green and reliable and constant, but you can't have all three. And our inability to find a way to get all three potentially will be the death of our civilization. That's a cheery thought.
So when you're writing that, how does that feel to be setting that kind of idea on paper? Is it cathartic? Do you end up digging yourself, writing yourself into a black hole of depression and darkness?
Those are opposites, of course. If it was cathartic, it would be good. If it's depressing, then it would be not good. It's kind of neither. I don't write... I mean, it would be foolish to write with an eye on how the act of writing that will make you feel. That isn't what it's about. You write because the book needs that section, because the balance is the architecture, because you feel it's true or potentially true, because your mind and the book and the dialogue between those two things take you there. So in a way, it's neither here nor there, kind of how it makes me feel. It's just that's what the logic of the book dictates, so... I follow and obey.
It just struck me as interesting that, like, actually it starts in what, the 84 heyday of kind of just greed is good, and then it ends in a long time in the future where that greed has been...
It's come home to roost. Yeah, the greed's come home to roost in a way. That's the end of the road that perhaps the 80s started us out on. Perhaps. I'd love to be wrong. I have kids. They'll be... about our age in the 2040s, well, a bit older, but not much. This will be their world, and I hope it's not as grim a one as the one I portray. But unless we can find some energy source that isn't oil, that isn't fossil fuels, then how are we going to make stuff? How are we going to move anything? How are we going to fuel the fleets of container ships from China that bring us everything we need? How are we going to build them in the first place? How are we going to feed ourselves? How are we going to fly? I do not see any answers. I mean, all I see are new types of iPhone. We're fueling, we're powering our world still on technology that's basically, with the exception of nuclear fission, hasn't really changed since the 1940s.
It's interesting because, like, in the book, and I guess the idea is that, you know, you think of the future and you think of great leaps of progress, but actually when the power runs out, it's an incredibly fast regression to medieval kind of times, right?
Well, Hurricane Katrina was the one that hit New Orleans. How long did it take for things to start looking rather medieval there? A few hours, right? I mean, I don't think this is a particularly intellectual, radical position. In a sense, I'm not making anything up in the book. I'm just sort of relocating what you can see happening when civilizations crumble and when the supermarkets, lorries from the wholesaler for whatever reason, don't show up at the supermarkets. It's sort of all from newspapers. It's not really from a crystal ball.
Keeping the realism and then those very precise drops of, like, hey, there's something fantastical going to happen. There's these weird blips within the story where you start to realize as a reader, oh, there's something else happening underneath the surface here. Yeah. And then you have these bursts. I think you mentioned Section 5 being impossible to explain. These bursts of real, like, heavy, fantasy, sci-fi kind of ideas. Does that just feel, like, when you cut yourself off the realism leash, like, does that feel great? Do you feel that as a writer, or is it just a shift in register and you can very easily negotiate that?
Of course it is a shift in register. It would be really easy to do absolutely horrendously, messing about with the fabric of your fictional world. And you better do that for a good reason. You better make it work, or you'll be left with a creative writing course dog's dinner of a manuscript. And then you have to get it until Section 5, in my case, get it back under control on the leash really quickly, which is why, actually, the characters often... I'll say Holly when it happens in that section around page 60 through to 70. It's suddenly very different to what's been going on, and kind of the laws of physics are suddenly radically altered. If she could remember that, it would alter the trajectory of her life and probably put her into some kind of an institute. So I wanted to do that, and then it's absolutely necessary that those memories are redacted. It isn't hard to do, but it is hard to combine in a way that you can get away with. Hugo's okay in Section 2 because it only happens at the end. So, and he actually takes the Faustian Pact. He's not a passive witness of that world. He's a voluntary entrant into it. And then the section closes, so I don't have to haul it back. It's there just for a whisker and a blink in the third section. But again, I use the redaction method to erase what Aoife and her father, Ed, the journalist, see on Brighton Pier. They know something happened, but they don't really know what. And then they've forgotten it, and the narrative gets... So that's quite easy to slip in, as it is for Crispin Hershey when Hugo appears in the wood in Iceland. Then, and so I've built it up and up and up, and I sort of open the door, then slam it shut, open the door, then slam it shut. Then the gates properly open in part five. And because that's solely bonkers, there's no combination problem. And then the sixth part, it's just a whisper of it to close the book on.
It's interesting that you talk about the passivity of Hugo. And I guess in some ways,
Hugo sort of is given the option to become a player, to become active, and you know what he does. Holly, she's just a witness in the first section. I interrupted you, sorry.
No, but just this idea of passivity in terms of the mortal characters versus the agency that the immortal characters seem to exhibit. And I wonder if there is a feeling that we as people don't have as much control over the world as maybe we should or would like or could take.
Do we have any control over our world? We have some control over our immediate surroundings. But damn sight more than our ancestors did, probably. You know, kind of if you're a serf in some god-awful society or if you're a woman in Saudi Arabia now, forget it. Control is nothing, that is not something you have. As citizens of relatively free democracies in the 21st century. This is probably about as good as it's ever been. Of course we're impotent, but we're human beings and not gods, and probably just as well. Is this the right neck of the woods?
I'm thinking about government structures. I'm thinking about the kind of control and agency and the feeling that as people looking at time, it's very hard to see how we can make an impact. You know, I think Holly addresses this directly. We didn't know when we ourselves could change everything. And then there's this feeling that there's these other forces that are actually just really, they're truly in control. And that's governments, that's corporations, that's the other business. And there's this kind of, I think the novel has those two levels. And I wonder if that's part of those two levels, the stratas of not morality and immorality. But then I guess in some ways, you know, what's immortal? Governments, you know, in a way. And corporations, you know, Coca-Cola is as immortal as you can get, right? A bank is as immortal as you can get. And these are the things that the institutions that control and will shape how our children will live, in some ways, maybe even more than you as a father or me as a father.
It's rather a good one, in my humble opinion, to sort of think of large companies, for example, and they usually are, as immortal organisms whose constituent cells, i.e. their employees, live and die, but which continue down the decades and down the centuries. The immortality of Coca-Cola, that's rather a nice idea. Can it think? That's the question. Has it got sentience?
They've got a program. They're machines for making money.
Yes, they are. And for procreating themselves in a way, or at least that's what franchises, isn't it, for sort of bacteriological procreation, and to destroy their opposition. But I guess we're talking analogies here. They're analogous to organisms.
And I guess I just see some of that, kind of those themes or that idea, kind of in the subtext or in the texture of the book, I guess.
Yeah, immortality is a big theme. I mean, hopefully the point is, by looking at immortality, you can look at mortality, but by looking at the morality of immortality, like, what would you do with it? And if it's dependent on other people having to pay for it with their lives, would you take that deal? Is one life a sacred and viable thing for you that you would say, no, I can't make my life longer at the expense of someone else's? Or would you think, oh, come on, there's 7 billion of us, the planet is groaning under our weight, people die all the time for intelligent reasons or for stupid reasons or for avoidable reasons, for unavoidable reasons. What's one more? All I want to do is survive. That's what we all do. You're not a vegetarian. Kind of, what's the difference? A cow dies, a person dies. Who cares? What's the difference? You can make a case. and kind of the anchorites do make this case, and Hugo accepts it. And other people don't. And would you?
Yeah, because it's me. It's my life.
It's survival. Yeah. Programmed to survive. And this is the means of survival. At least you'd think before you rejected it. That's what I like to think. I would give it consideration, and I'd understand why some people would accept it, even if I couldn't condone it myself.
Did I read somewhere, and you can tell me if this is untrue, and maybe this is a good place to end the conversation, but is this a prologue to another novel?
It's a very loose possible part two to maybe a part three that I'll do one day in what I might call a Marinist trilogy.
David Mitchell, everybody. His latest is The Bone Clocks. Get yourself a copy fast. Now, there's a couple of great events happening in Scotland centered around books. The two that we want to talk about very briefly and just highlight for you. Bloody Scotland Festival is happening in Stirling from the 19th to the 21st of September. It's a festival of crime writing, and it is going to be bloody brilliant. Get yourself to Stirling if you're anywhere in the neighborhood or are interested in crime and crime writers. There's going to be a huge international selection of authors present. You'll love it. We also have the Wigtown Book Festival happening in the beautiful locale of Scotland's only book town, Wigtown. It's a beautiful place, loads of bookshops, loads of fantastic events. It's absolutely lovely. Get yourself there. It's from the 26th of September to the 5th of October. Again, a wide range of international authors, loads of fun events for the entire family. The Wigtown Book Festival, everybody. We hope to see you there. That's all from the podcast today. Go back and listen to our conversation about David Mitchell if you get a chance. If you want to hear some more of the crime writing stuff and find out more about Bloody Scotland, you can listen to Lynn Anderson or Alex Gray on previous podcasts. Or maybe you're really excited about sitting down and reading a book. Pop your earbuds out, get yourself to a nice park bench somewhere, and sit down and take a little break from everything and enjoy a book. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. We'll be back in your ears very soon.